toughies.
Good afternoon. It's called a meeting of the House Military Veterans Affairs Committee order. It is 1:06 p.m. Thursday, March 23rd, in the state capital of Bloomberg, room number 120. Present, we have Representative Sponholt, Representative Rauscher, Representative Parrish, and myself, Representative Tuck. I'd like to record reflect we do have a quorum to do business. I just wanted to say that we have the Joint Armed Services people meeting, and then there's going to be questions and answers that are... Thank you. There's going to be questions and answers that are going to be happening in the speaker's chambers with the press at 1:15. And so I intend on trying to get through House Bill 165 and then taking a recess so we can join the brass and come back shortly around after 1:45. And maybe there's some picture opportunities that we can do there as well if you guys are up for that. And then take up House Bill 152. All right, and also want to thank Caitlin Ellis, our House Records, and Summers Cole in the back that's moderating the meeting, and also my committee aide, Kendra Kloster. So, Representative Parrish, if you would like to speak on your bill. Any other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply urge adoption of this bill. I think it would fill a gap which exists in current current statute. Right now, the Department of Administration has wisely made some accommodations to allow for military service to be recognized. That recognized, this would set that in stone, and also allow military experience, if pertinent, and if at a level that equals or exceeds civilian training, to be substituted for other minimum qualifications. Essentially, if you've been doing a job for the armed services for a few years and you've done it well, I don't see why you need a degree necessarily to do the same job for the state of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And so I'm going to open it up for public testimony. Public testimony is open. I do have Dan Wayne available from Ledge Legal if anybody has any questions. And and I have nobody on the off-net system to testify. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Okay. Seeing no one in the room willing to testify, I'm going to close public testimony. And
Mr.
any
Chair?
Further discussions?
Yeah, I had a question. We last committee hearing, we were talking about we talked about wanting a little more information from Kate Sheehan about how it is that the department would determine that military experience meets or exceeds position requirements if it's not, if it didn't already meet the definition, how would they make that determination now? And I was wondering if we had a chance to ask that question of her.
Sure. Okay, thank you. If you don't mind, state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan. I'm director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Through the chair, Representative, when you fill out an application, you write down what your job title was, and then there's a long section to explain what you do, because just as we have with military experience, other private sector jobs may not be titled appropriately how we understand them. So there's a large section for you to explain what you did in that job, and then we can follow up with you and have clarifying questions and to seek to understand exactly what you did in that job to make sure we give you the credit for it.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair? Yeah, one of the things that, if I remember correctly, that the state does is it uses some tools, some database tools to sort of determine whether or not somebody meets criteria for jobs. How is it that we can make sure that applicants are properly being sort of screened in rather than screened out if they don't know which words to use, for example?
Through the chair, for veterans, we have veterans preference. So if you're a veteran or if you are National Guard, we must consider your resume. We look at it. If you are a prisoner of war or a disabled veteran, you will get an interview. So we, all the hiring managers along with human resource staff go through the applications. And then to you self-certify that you're a veteran. We don't require any proof for that. You just mark that down.
All right. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. I have a real question.
Hey, Representative Rauscher.
Just a real quick question. I forget. Is this state or private this pertains to?
State.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? All right. What is the will of the committee?
Chair Tuck, I make a motion to move House Bill 165, version 30-LS0558/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, hearing no objections, House Bill 165 moves from committee. And we're going to take a brief at ease until about a little bit after 1:45 before we take up House Bill 152. And so we are recessed. I want to call the meeting of the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee back in order. It is 1:54 p.m., March 23rd, Thursday, and we are in the State Capitol, Gruenberg Room 120. And before us is House Bill 152, and this has to do with organized militia and relating to the authority of the Adjutant General. This is the third installment of some Title 26 changes that the administration has brought forward. And I would like to have our Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole present the bill to us.
Good afternoon. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole, State of Alaska, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Before you is a bill dealing with several provisions of Title 26. I would refer to it from a perspective just as an old maintainer, as a periodic maintenance bill. It basically takes language in Title 26 that was crafted in the 1950s and brings it current to be effective in the current millennium. In the process of doing that, we believe it creates efficiencies. It allows for continuity of providing services in disasters. It also provides clear-cut accountability and responsibility for the Adjutant General, which right now may be ambiguous given the current crafting of the language that is there. The first section, if we walk through it, is Section 1, which clarifies that the Adjutant General is not only in control of the National Guard, or the organized militia, which consists of the National Guard, Army and Air, the Alaska State Defense Force, and the Alaska Naval Militia, but is also in command of the Alaska organized militia. So there's a former president who had a sign on his desk that said the buck stops here. If the governor of Alaska had that same sign on his desk, this would take nothing from it. The buck still stops with the governor. The governor remains ultimately responsible and accountable for the Alaska for organized militia and the actions of it, and also retains complete authority to supervene or overrule any order or directive given by the Adjutant General, who's also the Commissioner of the State Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. What this does do is clarify the obligation that comes with command. With command comes absolute responsibility for the operation and the conduct of an organization. Even if somebody did not do something you directed and there's a negative outcome, you still are responsible for the success of the operation or the task that was given to you by the governor. This clarifies that responsibility that is inherent in that term command. The term control is only the authority to direct a subordinate to do something. It is not the it does not bring with it the responsibility for assuring it is done right, assuring that the right services are provided to Alaskans in time of disaster. Going with that, two is the authority to develop regulations for the internal administration of the Alaska Organized Militia. By regulations, in this case, we're not talking about anything that would affect members of the general public that would still be subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, but rather those internal necessary for good order and discipline. They're basically akin to the personnel policies that the other departments have. However, the organized militia does not come under the state classified personnel system, so we do not have a clean-cut mechanism at this point to institute those. Also, as a commander, it resolves some ambiguities with last year's HB 126, the Alaska Code of Military Justice, to assure the adjutant general can carry out all the duties as a commander over the Air and Army National Guard that's envisioned in that bill. Section 2 and Section 3 should probably be read together in terms of clarifying roles and responsibilities as to state active duty. We talked about state active duty in House Bill 3. Basically, state active duty is when the militia is put into a paid status directly to work for the governor of Alaska and responding to unique Alaskan needs. And the big thing that this clarifies is what we call for continuity of operations in a disaster. In the event of a disaster or an emergency where the governor cannot be reached, it authorizes the adjutant general to place a limited portion of the organized militia into state active duty to immediately deal with the needs of Alaskans. This became a priority of Governor Walker when we had to pull him out of a White House dinner to get authority for a search for Alaskans to get placed into state active duty, Alaska organized militia members, to assist with a search and rescue. That was an easy one. He had a cell phone. May have been a little protocol-wise, it was difficult. Logistically, it was simple. If we think of an earthquake with a compromised communication system, however, it is imperative that the organized militia be able to assist first responders immediately and not lose valuable time helping Alaskans while trying to reach the governor or the governor's successor. This can save us hours. It can save us days of having the organized militia assisting Alaskans rather than at the sidelines. Two important limitations on this authority. It is not unlimited. After 72 hours, there has to be a reassessment. If they have still not reached the governor for validation, is this still necessary? The other thing is this authority is limited to instances that do not involve affecting the civil rights of other Alaskans. It is not to place members of the organized militia into roles assisting law enforcement, such as running checkpoints or screening points or assisting with a security type task. Rather, it assists for helping with dig people out of the rubble or a fire that is out of control or immediate assistance after a tsunami. And in those cases, this can assure organized militia is able to help in those hours that are most crucial to save Alaskans rather than having to wait. Section 4 reiterates what I talked about in my opening comments, that the governor's orders are final. The adjutant general's orders are subject to being overruled by the governor at any time. As such, there's no loss of authority by the governor for the by this bill going forward. Section 5 is a recognition of a federal statute, 32 United States Code 109, which basically states the states have the authority to retain a state militia, in our case the Alaska State Defense Force, while also having a National Guard. This section provides that were 32 United States Code 109 to be repealed or amended, we would have to come back to the legislature for enabling legislation to clarify the relationship between the two entities. Given the federal role and some presumption of preemption and homeland defense and homeland security issues, we need this provision to deconflict the issues of federal preemption, 10th Amendment, and clarify that what we're doing is legal and proper from both a federal and state perspective. Section 6 adds the Alaska State Defense Force to the entities comprising the Alaska's organized militia. The original language identifying the organized militia in statute predates the formation of the Alaska State Defense Force. This is a function of that periodic maintenance I talked about earlier in terms of bringing better aligning the statutory language amongst different sections. Section 7 establishes the Adjutant General and the Assistant Adjutant Generals are subject to the regulations of state law and paid according to state law. This assures accountability and jurisdiction over those generals were appropriate for their role in commanding in the Alaska Organized Militia and the Alaska National Guard. Sections 8, 9, and 10 streamline matters that dealing with retirements are more consistent with the federal process or the federal level, where you don't have to, where somebody's application to retire does not go to the president. It's resolved at the service level. Allows for streamlining and saving time in the governor's office as well as our office going forward doing such things. Section 11 is another section that basically on its face seems interesting. It releases our obligation to build armories before issuing equipment. This requirement made sense back in the 50s when the federal government built 70 armories, 100% federally funded across rural Alaska. Today it constrains our ability to let the Alaska State Defense Force grow into new venues where there is interest to serve their fellow Alaskans, but we don't have an armory already co-located there. It allows us the ability to instead, if we can get in-kind assistance from another government or tribal entity, to house that Alaska State Defense Force unit to allow those Alaskans to serve there and not have to either limit their growth until we build an armory or discuss the capital procurement and ongoing operating cost of maintaining a facility for the Alaska State Defense Force armory. Section 12 deals with education assistance and basically puts the Alaska State Defense Force in the same program as the rest of the Alaska Organized Militia, that they would be eligible for this program when funded, and it hasn't been funded for years, as we all know, and retains the Adjutant General's authority to prioritize how those funds are dispersed based on rank or service or needs or other recruitment issues. Section 13 reiterates that regulations adopted under Title 26 may not be contrary to federal law or regulation. As you know, our department relies overwhelmingly on federal payments, either through the state budget or direct federal payments for operating the National Guard and the Alaska Military Youth Academy. This section clarifies that we will continue to meet the federal requirements to retain that eligibility. Section 14, directing that regulations are consistent with U.S. Armed Services regulations, assist in consistency for the Alaska National Guard, both Army and Air, in the administration of justice and the expectations as they transition between federal and state status. Section 15 allows the delegation of authorities from the governor for powers in the Alaska Code of Military Justice, except for general courts-martial, may not be further delegated. And 16 is another just house-cleaning provision that removes various items that we believe are no longer relevant or needed. That was kind of a fast overview. Mr. Chair, I stand ready for the committee's questions.
Thank you very much. I also want to let the record reflect that we had a full committee at 1:55 p.m. at the beginning of the meeting. Representative Rauscher, Representative Sadler, and Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Chairman Tuck. Through the chair, how many other states in the United States actually are involved in this type of a thing?
Through the chair, this was not a recommendation of Department of Defense. This was our own analysis of our laws and comparing them with others, and we looked at probably 20 other states and found inconsistencies where our language appeared to be dated to them. We can do more staff time to look at the others, but this was identifying inconsistencies in our language, such as making the Adjutant General the commander, giving the Adjutant General the authority to promulgate internal regulations, giving the Adjutant General the commander in time of emergency for short-term limited state active duty.
And through the chair, how many other instances in the past has the unavailability of the governor been there, not there, for instruction?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, at this time we are not aware of instances where the governor could not be reached. However, if we look at a mass disaster such as the next Good Friday earthquake, that we don't want to wait until we've dug out of the rubble after a time where we are unable to deploy the organized militia in the crucial period where we have a vulnerability here that we know in other states that they have addressed it by giving the Adjutant General this limited delegation of authority but not responsibility.
And through the chair, so we have a second-in-command, Lieutenant Governor, does not take over?
No, I don't believe so. I'll let the
through the chair, Representative Rauscher and Mr. Chair, in the case of a master's, not automatically, there's a process that has to occur before they can determine that the governor is not available and that the lieutenant governor assumes those duties. It is not an instant battlefield handoff, as we would say in the military. There's a certain process for the transition of power, just in the fog and after a mass disaster, that could be excruciatingly long going through that.
And through the chair, if the governor is then found right after this exchange of power has happened, what happens then?
Through the chair, I think I owe you probably a written answer to that going in at length. We in Alaska have not gone, to my knowledge, have not thoroughly looked at the process where the governor appears missing or unaccounted for and it's necessary for a temporary transfer of power. I'd prefer to brief that separate in writing rather than trying to do that as a hip shot today.
And well, I don't know. It's just kind of foreign for me, so I have a lot of questions unanswered in my head, and appreciate you that you have those.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, will follow up. Other states recognize this as well for this need for the immediate ability to put the organized militia into life-saving roles, and we recognize the common sense of those other places and. We know, too, up here, just at times it can be tough to reach someone when the phones go down and everything else.
Right.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Dole, if the basis for the bill is that the contention that the governor sometimes is not available, I think you owe us a pretty clear explanation of when the governor has not been available. If this is a solution, we need to know what the problem is, if there is indeed a problem.
So the chair, Representative Sadler, at this time we're aware of no time where the governor has not been available. However, after the mass disaster where his house is also in the zone of impact is what this allows for, where the governor is physically impacted by a mass disaster as well, and we cannot readily ascertain his location or his condition. This eliminates delay in having those forces go out and augment and start assisting their fellow Alaskans. At this time, we're aware of no such occasion.
I've heard the expression through the chair that if the balloon goes up, delivery of the mail is going to be the least important of our problem. So if there's a tremendous mass casualty thing, that might be a situation. Let me ask a basic question. Why does Save Alaska have a state defense force?
The Alaska State Defense Force exists by statute to help civilian authorities at a time when the ability of civilian authority to safeguard the public and meet public safety concerns is inadequate.
Through the chair, we know that several places in statute organized militia is cited. That includes both the State Defense Forces and the National Guard. Why is there, what I'm getting to is, does the state National Guard have the same function or could it have the same function?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, is it possible for the both are part of the organized militia, and as part of the Alaska organized militia, both have a role in disaster or emergency response. The Guard can't have that part when it's deployed or unavailable or the capacity exceeds what the National Guard can provide. We saw during the deployments after 9/11 that at times the National Guard was thin at times. We also saw, if we look at that true mass disaster, it may exceed even with the whole Alaska National Guard what is available to deal with a given situation here. And also, particularly as our National Guard and active duty military remains concentrated on the rail belt system, primarily in Alaska, we have all our eggs in one basket. To the extent we have distributed Alaska State Defense Force units elsewhere that can fly in, be flown in, and provide assistance, we provide another means of assistance that way to our fellow Alaskans.
through the chair. Well, my view is that unless you want to plus up transportation and housing and armories and training and so forth, it might be redundant. It might be better actually to have the National Guard with its transportation capabilities to deliver capacities to achieve a mission in rural Alaska, and that is to preposition all that capacity all around the state, but that's a policy call we'll have to make. Has there ever been a time when the National Guard has been unable to fulfill its mission to support civilian authorities in case of disaster?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, as I sit here today, the 1964, I was 1 year old and not in Alaska. However, if I look at the pictures taken across Alaska, I would note both National Guard patches in South Central Alaska after the Good Friday earthquake from units outside the Anchorage Bowl, as the Alaska State Defense Force would come in today to assist South Central if they hit from rural locations, but also active duty military patches also on some of the folks on those street corners. So at that time, it appears active duty military assistance was also necessary. However, I wasn't here personally.
So my question stands, was there a time when the National Guard has been insufficient to assist civilian authority? And you say the only time that that was the case was in the Good Friday earthquake in 1964?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that I'm aware of, yes.
Okay.
Any further questions?
I do have several, but I'll stand down if other people have questions.
Okay,
otherwise,
I just want to point out that the bill does allow the Adjutant General over the organized militia, and it's not just the National Guard, and it's also the Alaska State Defense Force and the Naval Militia to go along with that. And I think there may be times when all three may need to be deployed depending on the nature of the situation.
Mm-hmm. What kind of circumstance would those be?
Pardon me?
What kind of circumstance would those be, Mr. Chairman?
Well, some unimaginable ones. It could be, you know, attack from Korea. I mean, who knows what it would be in those situations. But we also have, before we just did it on wildfires. Now we are adding other natural disasters that could potentially happen. And we've already had history here in Alaska of a pretty strong earthquake, and we don't know where the next one may be. It can be out in the Aleutians. It can be in Southeast. It can be it can be in the interior, in which case you want to be able to have all those resources at your disposal.
Well, the question I'm asking, though, Mr. Chairman, is whether the Alaska National Guard is the appropriate function, is the appropriate force to do that kind of stuff. I'm not sure if we need to have both belt and braces here to try and recreate the capabilities and the expense of the National Guard everywhere in Alaska based on a highly unlikely contingency is a policy call for us to make, but I don't know if it's quite a prudent thing to do.
Yeah, and just want to point out that already in statute was Alaska National Guard and Alaska Naval Militia. What this does is adds in the Alaska State Defense Force. Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in case I botched something in my answers there, I want to be clear. The Alaska State Defense Force is incredible as basically a zero-cost entity. These are volunteers. We don't pay for their armories. We don't pay for their uniforms. We don't pay for them training. We don't pay for them procuring their own equipment in order to do things. So on that piece, that is the part we're talking about distributed across Alaska that we'd like to grow. These are just Alaskans ready to serve fellow Alaskans at minimal
chair,
to no cost.
Through the chair, Mr. Dole. Well, actually, this proposes to use state funds for education for state defense forces. It proposes to have armories, proposes to pay them for training and to cover them with workers' comp, so that low-cost status, which we are so proud of now, might not long be the case.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this clarifies that we do not have to provide armories in order to establish a detachment in a current place. Under the current law, we would have to provide an armory. This says that we do not have to provide an armory. Second, it allows for the prioritization of education benefits should the state choose at a time to do that. It is not mandatory. As we discussed on HB 126, we've determined that the workers' comp provisions actually are a zero-cost item. They take us out of what we call the tort lottery of somebody instead going to litigation, charging us for attorney's fees, and then seeing where a jury comes in on that. So we would maintain that that provision is also zero-cost.
Through the chair, you can probably tell from the tone of my questions, I'm beginning to wonder if the intent of the administration is to make the State Defense Force a duplication of the National Guard. And it's a fair question to ask what the cost and the implications are for state policy.
Thank you very much, Representative Sadler. Representative Ledoux and Representative Spahnholz.
So I've just got two questions. Commissioner Dole, Naval militia, it refers to the naval militia throughout this bill. What's the naval militia? Do we have a naval militia?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, some people opine that the State Defense Force is the least known part of our organized militia. I would opine it's the Alaska Naval Militia. The Alaska Naval Militia are drilling naval reservists and Marine Corps reservists from Alaska who have chosen to voluntarily affiliate with the state on their own, do additional training so that they can serve in state active duty in time of emergency. In that role, they would primarily be used to augment command and control centers, such as the Joint Operations Center, but they also have some really fantastic logistical skills. But the only time we pay them, were we to put them in a state active duty role in mass disaster. Otherwise, they train on their own, just like the Alaska State Defense Force folks. The difference being that they're also paid to do drill weekends with either the Federal Marine Corps Reserve or the Federal Naval Reserve. And we're not hiding a fleet from you out there. They don't have anything.
Thank you. I just had never heard of it. And then I get one more question, if I can.
You do, yes.
I think you mentioned something earlier in your presentation that the organized militia would not be doing police work. Did I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if so, again, I may have misspoke. It is not the only thing it would be doing. It is true we have military police units in the Alaska State Defense Force, the Alaska Army National Guard, as well as the Alaska Air National Guard. So what I did say is it would not be the adjutant general could not on her own deploy the that law enforcement function, if you will, from those entities in time of disaster where the rights of Alaskans could be implicated, that would require the governor or the governor's unfortunate replacement to actually make that call. The ability of the adjutant general to do that emergency call out is limited to non-law enforcement roles, if you will, i.e. like the fire department that is part of the 176th Wing or the search and rescue helicopters or other means to immediately assist Alaskans with health safety concerns, but not looking at a security or law enforcement role.
Just one follow-up. So I'm not quite sure I understand why police would be auxiliary police would be precluded, because I'm seeing in Section 2 it specifically talks, and this is lines 19 and 20, whenever any portion of the militia is ordered into active state service by the governor, it becomes an active police force. And I realize that's talking about the governor. But then here in 1, it's actually pretty general about what it's talking about. I don't see carry out the policies of the governor in military affairs, and that's from line 8. Where does it say that it wouldn't be, that the regulations that are going to be promulgated wouldn't give the adjutant general the ability to exercise police authority?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we believe Section 3 provides that limit. And the reason that limit, if you think about that sign we talked about on the governor's desk, the governor believes that sort of call where Alaskans' rights are going to be implicated should be made by the governor, and he does not feel it should be delegated, is why we requested drafting in that manner. And
C, I believe.
That one.
And
there is regulatory policy of the use of military power. There is regulatory prescriptive unless proof is done before giving the order. Unless
So, through the chair, if I look at Section 3, which my print off is on page 3, Section C, is the section that we believe addresses that law enforcement role, and the we believe in that case that given the constitutional rights of our fellow Alaskans, that authority should remain with the governor of Alaska as opposed to be delegable in time of emergency.
I've got a thank you for now. I may look at this a little bit more closely and try to understand it.
And Representative Reinbold, Representative Rauscher, and Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we were having the conversation earlier about sort of what, you know, what sort of very unusual situation would we be in where we wouldn't have access to both the governor and the lieutenant governor, I was sort of, you know, spending a little time thinking about that. And it's one of the challenges of disaster preparation, emergency disaster preparation, is that you have to be able to sort of contemplate every possible permutation and every scenario you possibly could imagine, and many of which we've already thought about, but some of which weren't probably even physically feasible at the time that the original statutes were written. And I was thinking of a recent example when I believe both the governor and the lieutenant governor went to Japan on a state gas line junket, and for lack of a better phrase, and they were both in the hour for in the air for many hours. And while eventually you might be able to get a hold of them during that time, there could easily be sections of time when they were in the air for 9 to 12 hours, depending on which route that you took. In which case, if there were an earthquake and then a subsequent tsunami or something like that that took place, each of those hours would be really precious in terms of response. Is that the kind of scenario that we would be allowing to permit if we advance this piece of legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Spanholtz, we crafted it as a time when it was not possible to reach the governor. I would posit most times in the air, just from a aviation background, you can actually reach somebody by satellite or high frequency radio. However, I see it more as either the mass disaster where the tsunami and the earthquake take away the means to communicate with them, the electromagnetic pulse from whatever source that renders us unable, even though they're fine and we're fine, to talk with, to reach them in Juneau from Anchorage, or just the other imponderables. We have Mike O'Hara is our Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We call him the Master of Disaster. And in looking at instances across nationwide, one of the greatest challenges is always overcoming the friction of compromised communications. And at some point, we can't foresee how exactly that will happen, but there's always seems, after something happens, a lot of challenges and what would otherwise be a quick message or phone call.
Okay, so I'm heartened to hear that we can actually reach people most of the time when they're in air. That gives me comfort, and so that sort of in my mind kind of narrows the number of times when this might actually become an issue, because we are talking about a pretty unusual scenario. And then we have the stopgap, which is that the buck always stops with the governor, and I think that's sort of clearly codified here, that if the governor were to then become available and disagree with the adjutant general's decision for some reason, he or she, the governor at the time, could then overrule the adjutant general and pull that back if there were any sort of difference of opinion about that sort of a thing.
The Chair, Representative Spanholtz, that's what we believe we captured in reemphasized in section, I believe it's 4, but the decision of the governor is final, and the governor always has the right to overrule the adjutant general in a military matter of the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold.
This isn't going to be music to your ears. but I'm just very concerned because it seems like this is a volunteer state defense force. I know people in my community have been completely disillusioned by the mismanagement of the state defense force over the years. The Military and Veterans Affairs just went through a pretty nasty chapter, which I believe changed the executive branch completely. And we have a different commander likely, because this did have pretty dramatic impacts on the state under General Katkus. So I am extremely skeptical, because this is basically my backyard and people in my community were strongly affected, and justice has not been served We may have rewritten the criminal code, but justice has not been served. People are still suffering tremendously in Alaska because of the misconduct. So I just take a step back in regards to this. These are volunteers that are trying to pour their heart and soul into making Alaska better. And all this federal money to be federal compliant, to get federal regulations, it's exactly what I think is not the place and where I want to go with this State Defense Force. So I have huge reservations with this. And also, the Lieutenant Governor, I was reading in the Constitution, it seems to be very, very simple where the Governor can just say, the Lieutenant Governor, I know there's a third in command with the Craig Fleener as third in command. To me, this is not feeling right in regards to this bill. And what if then the adjunct general's not available? I mean, it just seems like we already have something in place. We're kind of creating a problem from a non-problem. And with that, I just want to say deep reservations of who in particular is behind the writing of this legislation. And I just think there's tremendous concerns in this bill.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, first I, too, thank the volunteers in your district as well as statewide, those Alaskans in the organized militia of all the different branches who have stepped forward to serve their fellow Alaskans and Americans in time of need. Looking at this bill, one of the things that it does in saying that the adjutant general is the commander is it removes any ambiguity as to the obligations and responsibilities of the adjutant general. That is a term that has been developed over centuries of definition as to what responsible and ethical command is, and provides for that clear-cut line of defining the scope of what is reasonable and not as reasonable in that position that may address some of the concerns you have. As to the Alaska State Defense Force, that entity would not be subject to federal funding or federal regulations. It remains the state of Alaska as the state government's militia. It is under the control. It is under the funding. It is under the guidance of this. As long as we do not improperly use federal resources for it, that puts us in the federal penalty box. However, the Alaska State Defense Force will continue to meet the requirements as set by Alaskans, not by the feds.
Can I follow up with one question?
Yes, follow up.
Thank you for your indulgence. Bottom line is I've seen education get taken over because of federal regulations. I've seen health and social services get taken over. You know, the money that's you get, we've shown that sometimes when you take the research done in California, one federal dollar, you have to use eight either state or local dollars from. Bottom line is this is feeling like more of a police state to me, and I just think it's going against what the intentions were for the State Defense Force. So with that, I'm just going to reserve deep reservations on this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Representative Reinbold. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, page 2 of your legislation line 4 and line 5, the Alaska National Guard and the Alaska Naval Militia and their members are subject to federal laws and regulations relating to the National Guard and Naval Militia. So I see a lot of what Laura, I'm sorry, representative from Eagle River was saying there. And so I think it's ultimately, and I may be wrong here, but is their commander in general not the President of the United States?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, their commander-in-chief is the governor, and their commander, if this is passed, will be the adjutant general. Unless they are mobilized off defending this nation in Afghanistan or they're protecting our skies from incursions or performing a search and rescue, as members of the Alaska National Guard, their commander-in-chief is the governor. This clarifies, however, that in order to retain funding eligibility, because in that role, usually they're still being paid under Title 32 of United States Code. We have to maintain consistency for those components, but not the Alaska State Defense Force, with federal laws and regulations. So even though they're under Governor Walker's command as the current commander-in-chief, we have to comply with the federal laws and regulations to maintain federal funding eligibility for those entities while executing federal funds.
Through the chair.
Representative Rauscher.
federal laws and regulations relating to the National Guard and Malaya Militia, not just federal laws. In other words, there are those that we obey that they are probably making sure we keep when they are in governing power there, and then there are those that they are governed by, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, well, first and foremost, we looked at Title 32 of the United States Code, but there are other broader things, too, that we must comply with in terms of the Anti-Deficiency Act, which is how we expend funds. Also, frankly, the U.S. Constitution, we cannot, when using Title 32 funds, do something contrary to the Bill of Rights of Americans and Alaskans.
Through the chair, if the governor is not reachable, who is the adjunct general subject to?
Through the chair, the adjutant general is always ultimately subject to the commander-in-chief and her decisions as the commander, i.e. the governor or the governor's replacement if the governor is unavailable after a disaster. This looks at where the governor is not reachable for an immediate response, or it's unclear if there has been a succession, that we do not hold up launching emergency responses such as firefighters to pull people from a rubble pile till we figure out who's at the helm to make the decision. Ultimately, the adjutant general's decision is always reviewable and subject to the call of the governor.
I understand that, and through the chair, the governor is not contactable in this scenario I brought up. So who does he answer to above him?
She. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, he or she, depending. Hopefully an interim law. It isn't a short-term one.
I'll go there with
will
that.
Be for the immediate call. This would give the adjutant general the authority to go forth and save Alaskans. Subsequently, we're confident at some point we would either reach the governor or through the orderly transition of power, a new governor would be identified and sworn in, who would then be able to thoroughly review, revoke, or do other things with whatever the adjutant general said to do.
I again ask, if they are not connectable, who are they subject to?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, in terms, I'd like to differentiate between authority and responsibility. This law gives only authority, it delegates authority in those cases for the adjutant general to put folks in state active duty. Ultimately, we're confident at some point there will be a restoration of communications, and the adjutant general retains thorough responsibility for whatever actions were done during that time of incommunicado.
And if I may, Representative Rauscher, this is a temporary situation, but as was pointed out by our deputy commissioner, that the governor still has command. Is just delegated, and he's going to delegate these duties ultimately. But in the cases of where he is not available, cannot be reached, or is part of the disaster or emergency, until his replacement is selected, the adjutant general has the ability to be able to act to protect civilians. I forgot how it's laid out in here. Protect the public make sure that proper safeguards are in place to prevent human suffering and mitigate any great property damage to the state. So I think you're looking for some sort of absolute authority other than the governor. If the governor is not there and the governor hasn't been replaced yet, that authority will stop ultimately. The responsibility is still with the governor and whoever his replacement is, but it allows the adjutant general to act.
And through the chair, I understand what you're saying, and I realize all that in my question. I just think that that this general is subservient to somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the purpose of the bill in allowing the adjutant general to act in the event of the the governor's being unavailable, that's exceptionally wise. we don't know what crises will befall us in the future. There are the, what are they called, unknown unknowns, which yet may befall us. And there are a host, just a host of potential disasters that could come upon us unheralded, if you'll forgive the use of the word unheralded. So I really do commend that, and I think it'll allow, well, down the line, when disaster strikes, we can respond more quickly. So again, I applaud that. In on page 3, section 3, subsection F, line 22, I would propose a conceptual amendment with the indulgence and of the chair and the non-objection of Commissioner Dole. The organized militia may not be used against or to mitigate a lawful organized labor action or activity. I would propose amending it to read, the organized militia may not be used against or to mitigate a lawful action or activity, including those of organized labor.
Okay, so that's a motion. So, taking page 3, line 22.
We have a brief at ease.
Yeah, brief at ease. Yeah. Okay, committee, please come back to order. We're going to go ahead and go through the rest of the presentation. We're not going to move this bill out today, and we'll take up amendments later on down the road. I do want to write this down real quick.
What page is this?
It's page 3, section 3. Line 21 to 22, and I withdraw my motion. But I should ask, do you have any objection to that amendment of language?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, we have no objection. This language goes back to the time of John Peter Altgeld and the Illinois National Guard gang involved in labor disputes in the 1800s. It's kind of one of those standard provisions now. Mm-hmm.
For
Parrish.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For sections 8 through 10 on page 5, there's the withdrawal of a federal recognition of a officer's commission and the termination of that by the Adjutant General, the accepting of resignations, and the approval of the retired list. It seems to me like these three subsections, or these three sections, are non-emergency provisions. And I'm curious why it's proposed that we move the authority for these commissions from the executive to a delegate.
Chair, Representative Parrish, in looking at these three provisions, first realize for all of those there are also federal checks and balances on the decision, but the governor does not approve the retirement, resignation, or separation of any classified state employee under Title 39. Likewise, the president does not approve any of these actions on the federal side either. We believe this is more consistent with both the state just personnel system as well as the federal military personnel system. In the process doing it, it removes an unneeded layer of action.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Sather and Representative Dadoo.
Thank you. I've got a series of questions, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, on page 5, section 9, Mr. Dole, through the chair, are commissions in the National Guard provided or issued by the governor or by the adjutant general? That's good.
You want to repeat your question, Representative?
Who is the authority who grants or issues commissions to members of the National Guard in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there's two commissions an officer receives, a federal one and a state one. Both are done in the name of the executive, the senior executive, either the governor or the president.
Okay. If that is the case, this amendment proposed to the state law in this would say that the adjutant general could accept the resignation of such commissions as opposed to the governor. I'm curious as to why an authority, the governor's authority to issue a warrant would be supplanted. I'm sorry, why the, if the governor issues them, why wouldn't the governor be the person to accept the resignation?
Through the chair, consistent with the federal authorities also, where a warrant is issued, if you will, in the president's name for an officer's commission, the authority to do the same actions as the department level, Department of the Air Force or Department of the Army. This is just consistent with that level in terms of a lower level for acceptance, in terms of more appropriate with the significance of the action.
I don't, through chair, I don't know the provenance of this particular subparagraph D, but was that any different back when this State Defense Force law was originally put into statute? Is that any different than what it is now? If that was always the case, so why is it different here?
Through the chair, the State Defense Force did, you just said, Representative, State Defense Force and I State Defense, guess. Oh, okay, National
see,
Guard.
See, Native. That's not what okay. I'm playing the two, which
okay,
is
sorry, my apologies. Okay, yeah. So at that time, the Alaska state government was far smaller, I believe, and it was more doable for the governor's span of responsibility to have those actions flow through the office of the governor. However, it was... it's always been that you've always had a state and a federal commission while in the National Guard.
Okay. Just to restate the issue, because I fear it's being confused, this paragraph right now on page 5, lines 8 through 11, the current law says that basically the warrants to the National Guard or Naval Militia are issued by the governor, I think that's what I heard you say, and that if resigned, they must be acceptable only upon the approval of the governor. What this bill proposes to do is to eliminate the governor from the equation in receiving the authority to in receiving a resignation. My question is, why is that an important thing to do?
The Chair, Representative Sadler, in being more consistent with the federal side and state, we believe it allows for more efficiency, more effectiveness, less time delay in actions that a retiring member may want, or in any event, in terms of the administration of the force.
Through the chair, I don't know if accepting the resignation of a commission is something that's time-sensitive critical, but I'll leave that right there. Another question, I guess a philosophical question, what exactly cannot happen now under current law that could happen should this bill become law?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think the best case we should look at in that case is the 9/11 earthquake in South Central that compromises the communication system so that the governor or those outside of that immediate area cannot be reached to initiate the Alaska Organized Militia or authorize them into state active duty to start helping fellow Alaskans. In the case of the cellular lines cut, the phone system down, power system down, perhaps sunspots are out there, so even HF radio isn't available. And even just the time delay of flying someone down and back from Juneau to get the governor's authorization would cost us life-saving hours.
So I think you said the 9/11 earthquake. Did you mean either 9/11 or the Good Friday earthquake?
I'm sorry, I was mixing my metaphors here. Let's say the Good Friday earthquake.
Okay, fair enough. So what exactly cannot happen now? I think I hear you say anything cannot happen now, but there would be a time delay.
What cannot happen now is we, through the chair, Representative Sadler, is we cannot place the organized militia into state active duty in the appropriate time frame to save Alaskan lives when most needed.
Okay. And is it a fair assumption that the National Guard would be first on the list of forces that would be activated into state service before the ASDF?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, not necessarily. I think most likely it would. Again, it's hard since we don't have the disaster, we don't have the absolute needs, we don't know which groups were impacted. If in the true mass disaster, I would expect an all-call of the organized militia of the Alaska State Defense Force concurrent or simultaneously with the Alaska National Guard.
I guess without reading through all the laws, is it currently impossible for the National Guard to activate to save Alaskans' life in the case of a natural disaster now?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. We have some immediate response authority. It's limited to guardsmen who are already in a duty status. So if a guardsman is not in a duty status, we cannot use Title 32 United States Code funds to put them into a duty status to prosecute that. So if we don't have the right flavor, if we look like, say, the 176 Civil Engineering Squadron Fire Department, which has probably the largest additional capacity in the South Central region, they have one active duty firemen. The other 30 you would want, really want when most needed, are all guardsmen that who are not generally in a paid status.
I'm trying to envision a situation in which we have to go from peaceful comms SASCO ante to every hand on deck instantly. I think in many situations, wildfire, for example, there is a ramp up. There's a small fire. There's a response. It's insufficient. And it takes a while to ramp up. I just can't envision where we have to go from calm to we have to kind of have immediate activation of every force, and that's a problem if we don't have that.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, 5 minutes at a Richter 9.0, like in the Good Friday earthquake, is your best example
except
of that.
Except for an earthquake that happens once in, that's the worst one in North American history, one time. Okay, another question. There is a limited amount of education training funds. I know from being on the Military and Veterans Affairs Department subcommittee that the question of state expenses and for education for National Guardsmen is an important one. There are educational benefits. This bill would give the Adjutant General the ability to prioritize money away from National Guardsmen into Alaska Naval Militiamen or State Defense Forces. Is that a correct understanding? Can the Adjutant General redirect funds prioritizing State Defense Force members over National Guard members under this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, as we sit here today, the Adjutant General can still do that among different classes of the National Guard. This would also recognize the contributions of folks like Representative Reinbold talked about earlier to their fellow Alaskans and expand that pool of which could be prioritized, which groups would get a limited amount of money if this is ever funded again.
My specific question through the chair is, right now there is limited money for education for members of the Alaska National Guard. If this bill became law, could the Adjutant General prioritize, could she or he redirect that money to the State Defense Force?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, today there are, let's say, two
under
types of
bill.
Money.
Under this bill passage.
Under this bill passage, there will be two types of money. Federal money, such as post-9/11 benefits, VA vocational rehab benefits. This bill doesn't touch those at all. That money cannot be taken away from guardsmen today. The other group, though, in terms of state funding available for National Guard members when funded, this National Guard and Alaska State Defense Force members, this would allow for that money to instead be possibly reallocated or a higher priority given to some classes of Alaska State Defense Force participation than Alaska National Guard participation.
So through the chair, the answer to my question is yes.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, limited to state funds within certain limits, yes.
So if I clarify that to say, could the Adjutant General redirect state-funded education funds to Alaska State Defense Forces in opposition to National Guardsmen? And the answer is yes?
I'm
looking for a clear answer, Mr. Dole.
And if I'm looking at the clear language in terms of the allocate, how it allows the Adjutant General to prioritize, and my concern is that the Adjutant General can set different priorities or tiers of funding in terms of which groups may be eligible at a higher priority. In that environment, if you will, yes.
Good deal. Could you tell me how much money is available for education in the National Guard, in the Military and Veterans Affairs Department's budget?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, zero.
Zero. Okay.
Zero.
So, but there is a potential, should funding become available, that it could be directed to State Defense Forces.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm hesitant to say redirected when it hasn't been established that it would go to them first.
Right.
But it could be allocated, the Alaska State Defense Force could be given a higher priority than the Alaska National Guard.
And last question on this line.
Okay, through the chair, please, Representative Sadler.
Okay, certainly, through the chair. Through Mr. Chairman Tuck, Mr. Dole, is it the department's intention to come back in future years to ask for education money to increase that level from zero to something higher?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if I look into my crystal ball today, I don't see that on the event horizon. I cannot speak for what future deputy commissioners will tell us in future years. However, it is not an intent as we sit here today.
Okay. Another question, if I could?
Sadler, Representative Ledoux.
Take it back to the queue then?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, two things, if I could, Mr. Chair. First of all, on Section 12, following up, I guess, on Representative Sadler's questioning. So even today, if this bill is not passed, the Adjutant General could authorize payment to the Alaska Naval Militia prior in preference to the National Guard. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct.
And has that ever happened to your...
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, not to the best of my knowledge.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And then I have one further question. When we're talking about a major disaster like the Good Friday earthquake, does the National Guard, et cetera, tend to, and by et cetera I mean the Naval Militia, et cetera, does it tend to get federalized? Was it federalized in the Good Friday earthquake so that you wouldn't necessarily be so concerned about whether you could reach the governor because everything's under the president?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, no and no. And even if we look at Katrina and more recent larger disasters than that, the obligation and the authority for providing for public safety is primarily a state role. And that one we have, you know, 10th Amendment says we get to keep stuff like that, and we have kept that authority. We may have federal forces augment the state effort. However, it is the state will retain control of the National Guard in those scenarios.
And then just one further point, if I can, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. So, again, on Section 12, when we've added the Alaska State Defense Force in addition to the National Guard and the Alaska Naval Militia, is that just sort of cleanup language?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, we believe this is consistent with the intent to include the entire Alaska organized militia, recognizing that all of these militia members serve their fellow Alaskans, and just in terms of, we believe it's clean up to treat all the Alaska organized militia the same.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So we're running low on time. I have Reinbold, Rauscher, Sadler, and Parrish. I would like to adjourn at 3 p.m. because we have other committees. There's another committee that's going to be in this room. But I just also want to state that I think that any type of tuition funding that we have going to our Alaska militia, and we always talk about, you know, building up and recruiting our Alaska State Defense Force, I think isn't a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. Right now, there's zero funding, so this is just really a lot of this stuff has to do with the duties and authority of the Adjutant General. A lot of it is cleanup and rearrangement. You'll see that there are some sections of the bill that's deleted but added into a different section. Although it does allow the authority of the Adjutant General in cases of emergency where the governor is not allowed. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Chairman Tuck. Okay, so we're in the Gruenberg Room, as you know, and we spend every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in this room in the afternoon, and now Tuesdays and Thursdays. So I think I'm in this room more than I'm on the floor practically. But anyway, I'm hanging around a lot of lawyers, so bear with me, okay? but anyway, my understanding, just as a comment first, and then I'm going to, with his indulgence, four very quick questions, and you can just answer yes and no since we're almost out of time. But as far as I know, no other state has a bill like this. So I think we are, this is kind of on the edge of something new and that I'm very uncomfortable with. But to me, it seems to be very easy to transfer power to the lieutenant governor or to Fleener. I've talked to them what they do if they think they may be absent, and it's a very simple process. Your agency, we just had the bill in here. You know, your appropriations bill about how you're funded, and it seems like a lot of your money comes from the federal government. So it just kind of bothers me that you guys are kind of scooping up the State Defense Force, because I think you have a lot of federal ties. And that concerns me, because this is a State Defense Force. Well, just as a side comment, I was here. You know, my family was here. I was just about ready to be born, but in the 1964 earthquake, that was 52 years ago. And, I mean, it's just not like something we need to necessarily, of course I'm concerned about it, but whether we have to transfer form, the way we do government in this sense for something that happened. Not to say that it might not happen again, but I just think this is a pretty monumental shift right here. But let's just say a disaster doesn't happen. Let's just be Pollyanna just for a few minutes. What does this bill do? If this were to pass, just a quickly yes or no. One, and you can, I'm going to list them, hopefully you have a good memory, but does this increase the federal power or of the president in any way or the authority for this? My understanding is that the adjunct general does have ties to the president. Is that true or not true? Even a dotted line in any way.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, that is not true. The adjutant general has federal recognition as a general officer. However, all command authority flows from the governor to the adjutant general.
Okay, excellent. Three really quick questions. So there's does this increase any federal, because I see all this federal language and federal compliance and all that, does this increase any federal at all in any way?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, no.
No. Okay, great. Did you work with anybody in regards to the federal government in any way on this bill? Did you have anybody weigh in or anybody on this bill?
The chair, Representative Reinbold, no.
Great. Thank you. I love this. And does this decrease authority of the governor, yes or no?
The chair, Representative Reinbold, no and absolutely not.
Okay. And then does this decrease the freedom in any way of the State Defense Force?
The chair, Representative Reinbold, no. We believe it increases it.
Thank you.
All right. It is now 2:59 p.m. Representative Rauscher, very quickly.
All right, I'll just ask one question. All right, thank you. Through the chair. Is this legislature in any way, was there any ability or function of the governor that the AG would not be able to do according to this legislation? And if so, where does it state that?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, what this bill is limited to the authorities that the governor has over the organized militia, only the organized militia. So every other role that the governor has in an emergency or otherwise are untouched by this bill.
And you'll point to that later in my office someday, where you can make sure that I'm happy with how it says that.
The chair, Representative Rauscher, I'll follow up with you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. As we close, I want to thank everybody for their questions. I'm sure the department will be available for any further questions. We're going to put this bill aside. I would like to thank our Deputy Commissioner, Bob Dole, for his presentation and for taking on all the questions that we've had here today. And it is now 3 p.m. The House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee will stand adjourned.